Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. We've had an incredible start to the season. On Tuesday, Sagar and I did our discussion episode. Those normally air on Fridays, but we wanted to kick off the season with that on Tuesday. Yesterday, I had a great episode with my dad to talk about climate change and follow up with the episode with Alex Epstein that came out back in May. Today, I wanted to do another discussion-centric episode. I've brought back fan-favorite return guest, Frank DiStefano. He's the author of The Next Realignment. They also have a great YouTube channel you should check out. This is a very broad discussion, back-and-forth conversation episode about what we think are the big issues facing American politics. Once again, realignments, political issues that are up for grabs right now, and how we should all be moving forward. We're going to set up this frame through the news about the Andrew Yang Forward Party transitioning from a political action committee into an actual political party. So if you are not an Andrew Yang fan, apologies. But once again, it's a useful news note to tag this conversation to. A lot of great things here. Hope you all enjoy this episode, and we'll be back with more interviews, of course, on Tuesday. If you like the direction the show is going, if you like the increased cadence, if you really want to support my work and Sagar's work, of course, too, I would appreciate if you could go to realignment.supercast.com. You can support us $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership. Because it's Friday, you can also go subscribe to our Substack. That is linked in the show notes, and be putting out broader thoughts on this season and all those other great things moving forward. Quick note, of course, Sagar and I are actually in Portland, Oregon for a wedding today. So if you see us out and about in Portland, definitely come by and say, hey, it's definitely us. If you see us, hope you all have a good Friday and a great weekend. See you next time. Frank DiStefano, welcome back to The Realignment.
Thanks a lot for having me back.
Yeah, it's really great to speak with you. At this point, we need to just formalize the idea that twice a year we will check in on things. Folks who are longtime listeners of The Realignment will know that Frank wrote an amazing book back in 2019, I believe. It's called The Next Realignment. I will continue to push you to make it available as an audiobook because that is the primary form that I listen to most things. I actually read it, which was a signature of the fact that I really enjoyed it. But lots of folks have written and asking for the audiobook version. So you should think about something with that format. But we've done a couple conversations about just like realignments, the idea behind them. I really recommend that folks listen to our episodes from, I believe, May 2021 and June 2021. To be really having the starting point of what realignments are. But for this episode, I just wanted to do a Friday discussion episode talking about themes you've been interested in, different bits. So let me throw the mic to you basically and just get your thoughts on the third party discourse, especially now that Andrew Yang's Forward campaign has transitioned from a PAC into an actual quasi-political party. Love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I think this is a really kind of exciting time, particularly for me, who's interested in all these issues, because I think most people think Forward is sort of a lost cause, that this isn't a significant thing. And I think it's a very significant thing. And I think they have a shot at doing what it is they hope to do, but to do it, they have to go about it differently. And so this is, I find Forward really fascinating. And with third party discourse, well, here's why. All right. As we've talked about before, you know, I think it's pretty clear that we're in the beginning of a realigning era. I think our parties are collapsing. I think liberalism and conservatism as the foundation of our parties is dying, if not already dead. I think our coalitions are up in disarray. And so there's this huge opportunity sitting out there for somebody to seize to build a new party. And by a new party, I don't just mean a new name and institution. I mean a different collection of people and ideas. Because the way I see a party, what I call a party isn't just the name, you know, Democrat, Republican. That's irrelevant what you call the thing. What makes a party unique is it is a unique collection of people around a unique ideology and ideas. And So whether you have a third party with a new name and one of the names dies, or you have what I consider a boarding party, where, you know, you think about it like a ship, where you get a bunch of outsiders who they sail up in the ship, and instead of sinking their prey, they board it and take it over. So that's still a new party. It's a new party in the sense of it's a new group of people and ideas that maybe keep the old brand. That I am 100% convinced is where what's about to happen. And I've been waiting to see it happen. And until about, I think we talked earlier in the year or whatever. And there's been this huge change in the last year where people are taking this seriously and they're starting to do the work to do it. And Forward is on one side, this idea of trying to build a new party institution. And as we can talk about, there's also some really interesting stuff going on ideologically of people who are in the background who are trying to, I think, build a new ideology that could take over a party. This idea of a boarding party without the political institution, but an ideological movement. And I think of it like the progressive movement. What I find fascinating about the progressive movement. So one of the realignments in history was the populist and progressive movement. And that was created the party era before the New Deal era that we have today. And there was the third party, People's Party, that took over the Democratic Party on one side, right? You had the two Civil War parties that were based in the Civil War. And then you had a third party called the People's Party or the Populist Party that under William Jennings Bryan in 1896 took over the Democratic Party. But on the other side, you had this progressive movement, which took over the Republican Party. And the progressive movement didn't create itself as a party. It was an ideological movement. It was all these intellectuals and writers and thinkers who came together around a bunch of political ideas and a new ideology that ended up becoming the most dominant force in politics around the turn of the century. So that's another course. There's kind of two things happening at the same time. You have the Forward Party as trying to build, like the People's Party, like a third party movement that could take over a party or replace a party. And then you have finally people starting to do the ideological work to try to maybe build a new ideological movement that could take over a party. And all this is very exciting.
I love that you set this up. I want to do a quick note. We get very polarizing responses when folks basically say, like, why are you guys covering Andrew Yang so much? Why are you covering third parties so much? The two of you aren't fans of third parties, therefore, why are you talking about it? And the reason why we're doing it is third parties, and to your point, these boarding parties are a response to a dynamic that we think is real, which is basically the status quo is not working. So the pushback we always get from Yang folks is, wait, if you guys have a whole show, it's based on a realignment. It's not insane for us to think that realignment should produce something new. So I just want to say, like, that's why I think this discussion matters, separate from people's individual perceptions of specific actors. But here's what I want to just ask you. And this is why I love that you set this up from a historical perspective. The Progressive Party, the 1890s, that was framed around a very, very serious idea. The very serious idea being you have this industrializing economy, people are moving to the cities, you add monetary policy. That's what the whole, like, you will not crucify us upon a cross of gold speech comes from. That is appealing to this rural America. If you're looking at the Yang Party, Forward Party, my beef with them is if you read the Washington Post op-ed, they lay out in the first two sentences what they think the central political issue right now is. And that critique is there is not enough choice in the political system right now because the system is structurally set up to limit choice. First past the post, gerrymandering, open and closed primaries, ranked choice voting. Once again, I suggest the people who don't like Andrew Yang just look at that substantive critique because it's a real critique. My pushback, I want to know what you think, is I do not think that is actually what the central issue in American politics is right now. So the reason why the Progressive Party was able to actually win, and once again, let's remember something, they didn't actually win in the sense of like the 1896 election or the 1900 election, 1904, 1908, However, they still were able to build a real coalition around this central idea of rural America being left behind. I do not think technocratic, let's change the structure of how our elections run, is a similar issue of such weight. Therefore, they will not be able to pull off what the Progressive Party's pulling off. What do you think about that part of the, of what's your reflection on what I just said?
Yeah, I don't disagree with it at all. Although I separate out in my mind, on one side, what Forward says they're trying to do and what I think they're actually trying to do or are going to get backed into doing. So let me, and I think Andrew Yang would tell me I'm wrong, but I think he doesn't understand the parade that he's in front of fully yet, and he'll find out because, all right, so you're right. The Forward Party says, there's somebody, I can't remember who wrote it. Somebody wrote an op-ed and it had a phrase about it's not a party of ideas. It's the idea of a party or something like that.
Yeah.
Right. And this idea that it is intentionally presenting itself as we do not have an ideology. We are merely representing a movement to change the way we do elections, to create the field so somebody with an ideology can take over. I mean, essentially their argument is the Democrats and Republicans are broken and they're not working. Which we agree.
I'm not sure. Actually, we'll get to this. I'll let you finish, but I actually wouldn't agree with that statement, but we'll get to that later.
Okay.
Go on.
All right. I agree with that. I think that the current party coalitions and ideologies can't deal with our current era's problems and that we need something new. We need to reinvent them at the middle, right? So what Forward seems to be saying, I think, is that they believe that we can, that by clearing away the way we do elections, somebody else with ideas can then emerge. Mm-hmm. And that they are going to be the force that clears the way. And there are these ideas that are waiting in the wings that are being shut out of the system as it exists. And if they can just change the way we do elections, these ideas will just bubble up, which I don't agree because I don't think they're there. I don't think there's people with brand new ideas that have been formed yet that are just waiting to take over in the system. And if we just change the way we do elections, that will unlock them. I think somebody has to invent them. I think we need a movement of people to actually invent the ideas and then they'll sweep over the system. And so I think Forward Party in that sense reads the moment wrong. But I think that now they have bigfooted the space of new party. And they have come out there and people who are unhappy with the system are now coming under their banner. And when they do that, all those people will coalesce around an ideology if it's going to survive and thrive. So even though they think they don't have an ideology, I think they're going to either organically develop one or back into one because now they are the third party space. And so as all these people who are discontent and want change fill up the Forward Party ranks, they'll have to create that ideology.
And this is where I want to get to why I disagreed with you about the Democratic and Republican parties being a broken point. I think the Democratic and Republican parties are literally the least corrupt they have ever been in their entire history. That sounds very counterintuitive, but like once again, read any history book about even 1960s politics, and it's just shocking.
Oh, yeah.
What was going on?
The whole bosses. I mean, it's only bosses. In the last 30 years we got rid of bosses.
Yeah, you got rid of bosses, and if anything, the parties have actually become much more responsive. So this is the way I'll put it: the political parties are the least structurally corrupt, and are the most democratic they have ever been. Barack Obama never could have won the 2008 primary. Pre-1960s. Trump could not have run the Republican primary pre-1960s. That factor, whether or not, you know, you're pissed about Bernie Sanders or any of those different bits is what's new. So when I say they're not broken, what I'm saying is they actually reflect the actual wishes, intents, and coalitions that comprise them. I actually think very, very, very effectively. This is what Trump's win exposes in the sense that, guess what? Actually, it turned out a lot of Republican voters were not actually looking for Jeb Bush. They weren't actually as in favor of the Iraq war as the, let's just say, the think tank you know, industrial complex thought they were. And they definitely were not in favor of the mainstream, even Fox News consensus on immigration. The fact that the Republican Party has actually transitioned much more in service of what the coalitions it serves viewpoints demonstrates to me that it's not broken. So when people say that the parties, and same thing for the Democratic Party, Bernie Sanders lost the 2020 primary and the 2016 primary, not because that there was, you know, a fat man in a suit, like smoking a cigar, turning the wheels. It's actually just that 2/3 of Democrats just don't agree with him. That's just at the end of the day. And that reflected the result. So my point is, when people are saying the system is broken, I don't like the parties, it's not that the parties themselves are broken. And it's also why it's a waste of time to get stuck doing this debate about corruption. What you're actually just saying is you do not like the status quo that is produced by the coalitions and the groups and even the issues. And this is why your work is important, that's produced the status quo in these parties. So when someone says, oh my God, the Democratic Party is broken, I need to, you know, it doesn't work, it's corrupt. No, you just don't like that 2/3 of the coalition that comprises that party wants Joe Biden and wants Hillary Clinton. And you therefore need to find a different way to deal with that. Either you form a new party, to your point with Andrew Yang, or you actually say to yourself, how do progressives, not in one election, not in two elections, because it takes years, right? The People's Party, to your point, that was a 1870s on thing. Like William Jennings Bryan, the way this is probably, I think the problem, but I'll let you go, is that this comes from probably the way that we teach history. So you hear the story of William Jennings Bryan, and you're like, because I remember back from AP US history, this dude, he's 36, he walks onto the stage, he gives a speech, everyone throws their hats up and it's over. It takes 10 to 15 years. So my point to progressives who disagree with me is basically like,
it's like, okay, overnight successes in Hollywood, right?
Exactly. Like it would be, and what's it, even Trump was on the political stage for 30 years before he took over the Republican Party. So I'm just pushing on when people say things are broken. I think they are being a little intellectually lazy and are skipping a bunch of analytical steps that leads them to unhelpful directions.
All right, let me throw two sort of interrelated responses to that. Okay, the first is, when you're talking about that the parties are responsive, so this is an issue that I've been kind of trying to think through of late, and I don't have it fully formulated, but I feel that this is right. So there's one problem that we haven't really grappled with, which is party primaries.
Yes.
And that they're a new thing. Okay. And when we're talking about the bosses, so the upside of the boss era was everybody in the party got something, right? You had a smoky room and all the different bosses and factions of the party went to the convention and they brokered deals where everybody got something and was happy enough. Now, it was not responsive to the people necessarily, but it was definitely responsive to every faction. And so you got, you know, nobody loved what they got, but everybody got some of what was important to them. Everybody got some offices. Everybody got control over certain institutions, and they worked out their differences among the party. Okay. Party primaries have radically changed that to winner takes all. The way we do it now, since we have primaries, which is really, you know, since the 70s, is that everything has been primary driven versus boss driven, is now if you are the faction of the party that can win the primary, you get 100% of the pie.
Yes.
And every other faction gets zero. And this is, I think, what, like, if you look at the Andrew Yang critique, that's really what this is about, right? What's the problem is, both of the party, if you're a highly organized, motivated faction that you can win party primaries consistently, you get 100% control of the party. And when you take 100% control of the party, you give nothing to anybody else. You expect them to show up every year and vote for you. Because, and you get mad when they don't, like, hey, you're on our team, you're supposed to vote with us, but we get to run everything. And you get no offices, there's no congresspeople, you get no institutions, and you get zero part of your agenda, and we get 100% of ours because we win. I think this has been very distorting in politics and in our parties, and I don't think we have grappled with that or even really started thinking through that yet, because on the surface, you hear party primaries and responsive to the voters and majority, and you think, well, that's great. That's the way things should be. But like every reform, it has other reverberations through the system. It's like the civil service, right? The idea of having a civil service seems, hey, it'll be a neutral bunch of experts. They won't be, you know, political appointees that are just kind of, you know, scrying for patronage. This is going to be great. But then there's other downsides, which is, well, now they're not necessarily accountable. They can do whatever they want, right? Every time we do these reforms, you know, the Senate, well, we're going to, you know, we're going to have not an appointed Senate, but an elected Senate. And so now we're the, you know, we're not going to have boss driven hacks running the Senate like we did. And then, well, but now states lost more power, and now the Senate just becomes another House of Representatives. It doesn't really serve its purpose. And this party primary thing, I think, is a unexplored problem that maybe we need to do other reforms to deal with. That if we're going to be doing primaries, how do we deal with the fact that probably 60% of the party gets nothing and they feel discontent? And so they're not more responsive. They're more responsive to the winning faction and less responsive to everybody else.
Can I say one thing that's very fascinating? Then you got to your second point, but you've just articulated this a little differently than how Yang articulates it, because the way that they articulate this, having interviewed him a couple of times, is everyone outside the party system gets screwed over by primaries. So they're saying, if you're in a state with a closed primary, you get no say. And the only people who win are people in the primary. But your critique is actually one level deeper, which is that even if you are joining that party system, if you are a country club Republican, you always turn out to vote, you are still not represented in a way you would have been pre-1960s. I just want to make that very clear. Yep. You could keep parties completely closed, party primaries completely closed, no independent voters, and you would still have the problem you're describing. You're right. I've never heard someone articulate it that way. Sorry, go on to your second point.
Yeah. You know, and I actually think that's, what motivated Yang to do what he's doing was that his faction of the Democratic Party, he felt like he couldn't win. He wasn't getting represented. And so he had to leave the system, which has then led to this critique and ranked choice voting and all this stuff. And the people who started ranked choice voting were similar. I think a lot of them were originally the country club Republicans for the same reason.
To the letter.
They got pushed out of the system. So now they see themselves as independents, but they would have saw themselves as the losing faction of their party. And so now they want a multi-party system where what everything was going to be a faction of a party is now a separate party. And so everyone gets represented. And then essentially what we're doing is moving the deal making that was done at the party conventions and doing it in Congress now. Because how this will play out is that now what used to be one party with factions will be multiple parties that go to Congress and make the same deals they made before. But now instead of making them in the Democratic and Republican national conventions, they'll sit in Congress and make the same deals. And you'll end up with a system like Germany, where you have like the Free Democrats and the Christian Democrats are technically separate parties, but they're basically always in coalition together. Mm-hmm. And they make deals where they divide up offices, and they basically are factions of the same conservative party, but they, on paper, they're not. Or the Greens and the Social Democrats in Germany are basically just factions of what the left party is, but on paper, they're separate parties.
And this is why this gets fascinating to me, because I think another line, it's hard to do an interview of like a politician like Yang. So I'm just going to talk about things that I would talk about if I were a more incisive interviewer. I think the real thing that's interesting for me about the Yang forward third party space is I don't think it's reckoned enough with the binary nature of the current political moment and the political problem. So actually, I asked this to Andrew and he didn't give me a good response. I said, hey, so like, let's just say like you were president or a forward party person became president. Who would you appoint to the Supreme Court? Because that's obviously the binary nature of this problem. Because you could say, oh, like Democrats are broken, Republicans are broken, let's represent our coalition. But the binary question in front of the court right now, that clearly, as you're seeing, I don't think the Democrats are going to make the comeback for the midterms. But the second the political question swung from pure inflation to, hey, like, do we want to give Republicans more power over the court? Are you okay with Clarence Thomas saying that there could be an overturn of the status quo on gay marriage, contraception, et cetera? Are you okay with criminalized abortion in places that might not be comfortable with that? You start to see things swinging back more to the Democrats. So my problem, and this goes to your point about the German system, my problem with introducing more parties in a binary moment is it doesn't actually add anything. So if, let's say you get, you know, let's be generous to Yang and say that a fifth of the Senate are forward party people. That matters at a time where it's just totally open field. Anything goes. Like, let's say it's the 1990s. You've got this real, like, not to use the end of history cliche, but you have this like, oh my God, we're building the bridge to the 21st century. Anything is possible. We could let Russia in. We could not let Russia in. We could create a North American free trade. Oh, that's an open moment. But right now, the only actual question that matters in American politics right now is, was January 6th a unfortunate incident that doesn't really have any deeper significance? Or was it an insurrection that almost overthrew the American government? That is one of the central questions right now. Another central question right now is, should the court be more liberal or should it be more conservative? And if the forward people just enter into the political system in this binary moment, they're all going to end up just being Democrats, because that's the actual secret. I have yet to meet. And yes, I've met. I know that there are like forward party representatives, fans who are like pro-life, but I know a lot of like pro-life people. I would not describe them as capital P, capital L pro-life people. I would describe them as being akin to like Bob Casey of Pennsylvania, or even pre-president Joe Biden, where they're like, oh yeah, like I don't like abortion, but like gun to my head, I would probably preserve the Roe v. Wade status quo. So can you just help me understand this? Like in a binary choice moment, I don't see adding more parties actually changing, because the actual number of answers hasn't actually changed. This isn't about ideology. It's just like, do we want the court to be more liberal? Sorry. This is a better way to phrase this. The question right now is, do we want the court to repudiate the legacy of the 60s and 70s? Or do we want it to build something new and effectively serve as the equivalent of the Warren and Berger courts? But I'm curious how you think about this binary moments idea.
Okay. All right, so there's a lot to unpack there. So I guess the first thing is, see, my belief, and I know Forward would disagree with this, but part of what I find exciting about it is I think they're a way station to either take over or replace a party. I think that where things end is they have to find an ideology, a renewed ideology, because to implement their reforms of the system, they have to win. Like, they can't just implement ranked choice voting if they're 30%, because the Democrats and the Republicans aren't going to go along with it. So even to implement the reforms that they represent, they have to first win a majority to actually pass those things. And I think that more than that, all these people who are flooding into the movement they need to have an ideology to bind those people together over time. And those people come with ideas that will organically turn into an ideology. And I think Ford even has, you know, we pretend like pragmatic, technocratic, you know, policymaking is ideologyless when it's not. Mm-hmm. It itself rests on an entire view of what the problems are in society and how it is we're going to fix them. You know, the idea that we're going to use this method to solve problems is itself ideologically freighted in a lot of ways. But I think the most important thing is to hold together a coalition of half the country, right? You've got a country with 330 million people who are very, very different. I mean, like, it's hard in a country this size to get groups of people to agree on anything. And then you've got to find a way to take half of those people and unite them into a common cause that will cooperate in not just one institution, but in a federal system where there's a House and a Senate and a White House and state houses and governors. And you can't get anything done unless all those institutions are cooperating. Mm-hmm. And then you have to do it not in one election, but multiple elections, because this stuff doesn't happen in 5 minutes. Okay, to do that, you need a narrative, you need a story that tells people, here's what I think is wrong about our problems, and this is how to fix it. And so the story of what's wrong with our problems is our parties are non-responsive isn't, it's part of it, but it isn't sufficient. You have to have an idea. I mean, otherwise you can't build the thing, right? To succeed, you have to do it. And so they will do it, because even if I think right now they don't want to say that, because they don't want to turn anybody away from coming in the doors. But those people who come in the doors will do it organically, or they'll have to do it. And so I think that if Forward succeeds, which it could, it will become a major party. It will be back in a binary moment because the system is currently set up as a two-party system. If they're going to, they're not going to do the reforms unless they win as one of the two parties in a two-party system. And then maybe we go multi-party. But to get there, they have to win. And so your point about a binary moment, they'll be one of the binaries. And whether that is by killing off a party or pulling a William Jennings Bryan, you know, and your point that they're mostly Democrats, and it is, it's center right, center, they're central, you know, they're, and I hate center right, center left because it concedes the whole left right spectrum and blah, blah. But let's say, you know, basically moderates, it's center right, center left. It's all the people who are locked out of the party primary system as it exists, right? Those people will
if you're a center left Democrat, you're not locked out of the system. If you're a center right Republican, you are. That's just the one thing I would say. And that's the awkward thing here.
Well, they think they are. What was actually fascinating is if you're a center left Democrat, you're frustrated and you feel like your party isn't representative, whether or not in practice they have control, they don't feel like they do.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's, and so they are attracted to things like Forward.
That's okay. That's the way to put it. That's helpful. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you look at this thing and you're like, well, maybe the way this ends is they take over the Democratic Party. They become a petri dish to develop a new approach and ideology, which then pulls a Bryan and shows up at the convention and takes the thing over and merges it into Forward and births a new Democratic Party that's now got a coalition that's the Forward coalition. That's a possibility. Okay. So anyway, so that's the whole, but the second point that going back to the original question that I was going to say, which is also relevant to this, which is, I think the problem, okay, when we look at all these issues, this is the vacuum thing. One of the points that I have brought up with you before is that I don't think we're polarized. I think we're in a vacuum, right? To be polarized, you'd have to be able to define what the issue is that we're polarized over. And you can get into the weeds, like you say, this Supreme Court decision or where that there's disagreement. But like on the meta issue, I don't know what we're fighting about. Like I knew in the middle of the 20th century what we were fighting about. It was New Deal liberalism versus big government. Okay, fight big government or, you know, have policy and planning running out of the government to create progress for the workers and the least well off. Okay, I knew what that fight was about. I don't know what we're fighting about to be polarized over. What I think it's the opposite. I think it's like the 1850s, where right now there's a vacuum, where the old ideologies are dead and there's a free-for-all. And so people are jumping into politics to seize the free-for-all. And so certain issues are rising and falling. And you know, that's like the know-nothings, where they, you know, there was a vacuum that allowed an anti-immigrant party to show up for a few years and get all huge power and then collapse. Okay, because you couldn't build a party system around the know-nothings. That's what they learned. They could win an election, but they couldn't build and I think a lot of the stuff we're fighting about is a vacuum. And part of why everyone's frustrated is because there's a vacuum. And part of why there's so much chaos and disorder and this time of decay that we live in is because there's a vacuum. And nobody knows what to do. Nobody is organized. And most people in politics, I think, right, you know, we're the kind of people who think about this stuff, right? In the policy wonks and people in DC. Most people just want to plug themselves into the system, all right? Most people just take an off-the-shelf. It's the same thing. It's like buying bespoke versus off-the-shelf. People buy an off-the-shelf ideology, try it on, it's good enough, and go out into the world. Okay, well, if there isn't an off-the-shelf ideology that works, you get chaos. And so I actually think one of the biggest problems is I think all this disorder settles down when you have two off-the-shelf ideologies that work good enough for most people. And then it squeezes out the crazies, it squeezes out the radicals because now there's no opportunity. It makes everything, you know, you start solving problems, things start working, everything calms down. And so I look at, you say our parties are responsive. I just think actually it's a free-for-all. I think what's going on is because they don't have an ideology everybody's happy enough and locked in with, what's happening is every, you know, policy entrepreneur, every crazy person, every grifter can just jump into politics right now and get a microphone and have people pay attention to them. So I don't know if that does respond to what you said, but that's so, you know, I look at all these problems and I say, yeah, there's things we're fighting about, but I don't know what the fight is. I think we need to organize it around two narratives that say, here's what's wrong, here's how we're going to fix it. And then you get the whole of America to buy into that. And then everything starts kind of working and fixing themselves. And that's what I think something like Forward could be a way station to, or something like a progressive movement, because that's the other option. Mm-hmm. Maybe Forward goes nowhere, but what happens is a bunch of intellectual types get together and come up with a new working ideology, which they can use as a boarding party to take over a party, like the progressive movement did. And there are people who are doing the beginning work to do just that. And I think that's another option, right? If you're paying attention to the intellectual space, there's a lot of people who are trying to find alliances and come up with new ideas and figure out how do we build the new ideological faction that can solve problems and be compelling that we can import into the parties and reform it that way. So that's the other way that this plays out.
Something I'm curious, we've got a lot of responses to that, but I'll just ask a straightforward question. Could you really describe, I'll give my version, I'll ask you your version. I'd love to hear your description of like what's the political playing field issue right now? So like my version of the answer is, and this would be an answer that was different than when I first got your book in 2019.
Yeah.
The issue right now is that after COVID, you've got a combination of things, right? So like globalization is actually just breaking down. There's a second Cold War. Those are the two big era defining issues. You're going to look back in 2065 and those would be the things you're going to pinpoint. There's a bunch of things that like are really active right now, like the debate around immigration. You talk about education, you talk about higher education, but those actually kind of fit like with, actually, no, sorry. There are three factors here. One is the breakdown of globalization. Two is the breakdown of like great power peace since the end of World War II. And then three would be America's coalitions like shifting and changing, the country diversifying, but in kind of like a weird way. So like this is all the reference to like Maya Flores doing well in Texas as a Hispanic, like very conservative person. She probably isn't going to win in the fall, but there's been increasing focus on the fact that Republicans are actually finding ways to effectively win working class Hispanics because the country's polarizing around education, not merely class and race. So those are the three central issues. And I think the thing that makes me convinced that it's not that the parties are broken or the ideologies are dead is that I think we're just in this brief moment where the actual parties, the thinkers, the figures, the politicians, the podcasters, or the YouTubers in our cases, need to actually spend, I guess this is where we're agreeing, they need to spend their time actually thinking through those issues, because that's just like the central thing. I think the thing that's weird here is that, you know, I'm back in Oregon recording this. I'm talking to some of my friends. Some of my friends are like actually like state representatives now. So like, you know, like early 30s, like younger. And I brought up the Maya Flores thing. They had no idea. They're like, what are you talking about? Republicans are doing better with Hispanics. And once again, to your point, like this is all I do for a living. So I'm like, every time the New York Times does a piece, I read, but they're not thinking about it.
Well, wasn't there just a poll? It was like 50-50 or something like that. Right? Yeah. There was a big article, but
there's a crazy poll. Now, but
there's a crazy poll. It looks like now it's 50-50. And I think that's a permanent thing. I think it'll go more. I think, that's... Anyway,
No, please. So I was going along there. So like, what would you say? So just to sum up, issue number one, and this is for folks to think about back at home. What is your response to the breakdown of globalization? Can it be put together again, or do we need to just like lean into the opposite? How do we respond to a second Cold War style situation? And then how do you as a politician, thinker, elected official, voter, respond to the fact that the coalitions are shifting in ways around education polarization that you would not have predicted even 10 years ago? 10 years ago, because I know you read these books too, 10 years ago, the very obvious take was in 2050, Republicans are screwed because of—
Emerging Democratic majority.
The country's majority minority. Now Republicans are doomed. They have to change. What people just don't understand, because I don't think a lot of thinkers are politicians, right? People to play different roles, is Republicans can tell that too. Republicans see, I don't know if you've seen this YouTube video, maybe I'll find it, put it in the show notes. There's this incredible YouTube video of this Spanish language Trump ad. in like the Cuban part of Miami. It's incredible. Like, it's actually a fun ad, you know, like it's just like Latinos por Trump. It's just like, it's incredible. It's like very, it's a great ad. What people who basically say, oh, Republicans are doomed, they don't know that politicians watch that ad and they say, wait a second, I can do that too. And wait a second, like I want power, so I will shift. That ad is probably more transformative when it comes to Republicans trying to get Hispanic votes than a white paper from the RNC saying it's time to pass comprehensive immigration reform so we could win in a browning America. That's what people really undercount. So what would you say like your central open issues are that folks could intellectually organize themselves around?
Okay. And this is the big question that I've been obsessing over this year that you asked me. So I have a lot of thoughts on this.
Go for as long as you
and
do, please.
I don't, and I'll say, and I don't have the answer 100% because I think it's a really complicated question and it's really important to get it right. Okay. But before I go there, I wanted to respond to one thing, which is I think the problem with political people is they think demographically instead of ideologically about parties. Mm-hmm. And the biggest problem, and what you're talking about demographic change, is that people don't vote. Okay, it's easy to measure. They look at demographics because it's measurable. I can pull it. I can chart it. It's the same reason businesses mess up, because they manage the spreadsheet instead of the business. And politics very often looks at polling and they look at data because they want data. And so you look at demographics. And people don't vote demographically. They vote ideologically. Demographics support certain parties because of the ideas those parties represent, and those demographics disproportionately like those ideas. And when what the demographics care about changes, or when the ideas change, the demographics move around. And even then, they're never monolithic. So, you know, people who look at like party coalitions, like the Democratic coalition, the emerging Democratic majority, the mistake it made was looking at the Democratic coalition as a bunch of demographic factions instead of a bunch of ideological factions. And so they couldn't see when the ideas are up for grabs, demographics are going to change sides. It's the same problem with the Solid South, right? The reason the Solid South went from Democratic to Republican was because a new generation, you know, the older generation of people who lived in the South were populist, who supported the Democratic's populist ideas, and their kids had different ideological priorities. And so they went Republican. And it's not like the demographics shifted. It's a new generation of people had different ideological priors, and so they picked a different party than their parents. And it's not you know, it's not that the parties had to do anything. Demographics can change what they believe in over time because each new generation, anyway. So that's one thing. All right. The challenge, I think, for all of us right now is figuring out what is the crisis and what is the solution, right? Every political party in history has been a solution to a crisis that has united its coalition around a narrative and story about how to solve their era's crisis. And the reason our parties are dying is because they're both narrative stories about how to solve the crisis of the middle 20th century, which is no longer relevant. And so you can't sustain a coalition around New Deal liberalism, because New Deal liberalism was about a story about how to solve the Great Depression and the mid-century problems. You can't unite also around fight big government, because that's not what people are worried about. So if your whole party story is we're going to fight big government, and then you get these factions who are like, okay, so you need a narrative. So then you're like, what's our crisis? And then how do we solve it? All right. So that's the first question you asked, is like, essentially, what's our crisis?
Yep.
All right. So there's two, I feel like there's, I've been looking for one crisis and I'm wondering whether it's twin crises, are interrelated. Yeah. Right. There's two separate causes that are then sort of intertwined with each other. Like, what's the medical thing? Like cadaces or whatever it is, like where you get the two snake. It's like they're wrapped with each other. The first is, and I think a lot of what you were talking about is this post-industrial change, okay? It's the same thing we were talking about the 1800s, where we went from agriculture to industrial, okay? We have the internet, we have massive data, we have AI, we have genetic engineering, we have a completely different way that we live and work, because we've had a technological revolution that's still in the beginning stages that is disrupting everything. And that changes. So like, I think the COVID changes are, it wasn't COVID that caused it. It was just COVID allowed us to accelerate a bunch of changes that were happening. Mm-hmm. I think like, you know, COVID allowed us to see very quickly that we needed to make a bunch, you know, work from home. Well, that's because of the internet. Mm-hmm. Like, we have the technology now to work from home. COVID didn't. COVID accelerated something that was happening anyway. And then as we work from home, it also changes cities. I mean, I feel like in DC right now, it's a completely different place than 3 years ago. All of the places, I was just looking the other day to find a place to kind of sit down, like a coffee shop, to work with a laptop. And it was like hard, mm-hmm. because all those places were closed. The sort of the character of the places that have now sprung up to replace them are different. The city just feels like a different place.
It's not for commuting workers. The assumption is not like someone in Northern Virginia needs a place to work between metro rides. It's like different.
Yeah. It's, you know, and I think that now you're going to see over time, you know, people living out in Southern Virginia and just, you know, commuting in once every 2 weeks and living 2 hours out of where they work, all this. And that was change that was going to happen anyway. All right. And a lot of, so that was, you know, a lot of these changes that are happening is because of post-industrialization. And it's also, I did a thing the other day with Braver Angels, and it was with the guy, there was Forward Party, the guy, the head of the Forward Party in DC, Silas Kulkarni, was up there with me. And they asked him this question, and he had said, and I thought it was really true, and it really resonated with, was looking at it a different way than I've been looking at it, that the internet's effect on democracy. And I think that's a whole thing too, where our democratic institutions are based on mass media, they're based on sort of just a more local state-based versus national-based. Mm-hmm. Just the whole change of the internet and social media, but also data mining, our ability to target, all this stuff has changed the way the same institutions work. And then you're like, well, how do we shore up these institutions to continue to work with the new technology? It's not that the institutions need to go because of the technology, but they do have to adapt to a new reality that people live and work differently. There's different tools available, you know, that both individuals and interest groups in the government have different powerful tools. Well, how do we take into account? And then the way that everybody works, you know, the workplace is completely changing. The government has different powers with data and surveillance. There's just a million of these things. And I think they're all related, though, to this meta issue of technological change and creating new powers, new tools that have to get taken into account. And they're affecting the way people live and the way that they work and their cultural beliefs. I think a lot of the cultural stuff, too, is because we have one national idea space where you used to have more local and state-based sort of communities that cooperated through government. Now we have one national community. So we're having competitions between, well, what's that? If America is going to be one ideological community and we're all going to be part of it, well, now we're going to have competitions about, well, what are the rules? Who's going to control it? What is the beliefs? Where it used to be you could live in Mississippi and have one set of beliefs that were fine, and you didn't, and people from New York had a different one, and you didn't really have to interact with each other. Well, now we have a national marketplace and a national marketplace of ideas. It's not even just that we're watching the same TV. We're all sort of basically in the same schoolhouse. We're all students in the same school. And so that's causing all these problems. So that is the meta problem of, just like industrialization caused all these downstream problems, whether it be, you know, child labor, whether it be immigration, whether it be free silver, which was this, you know, basically deflation problem with agriculture. You know, it has all these downstream effects, or the fact that small towns died, mm-hmm. right? Because now that you had industrialization, it didn't just make farming unprofitable. Everybody left all the small towns and they moved to big cities. There's all kinds of downstream stuff. All right, so that's one crisis. The second crisis is the crisis of legitimacy of the American project. And this is one that I'm struggling with too. where, and I see this with young people particularly, and it is, I don't know if it's caused by, it's in part caused by post-industrialization and the fact that our leaders have been ignoring all this problem. And so our leaders have been failing for 20 years because they've all been ignoring the fact that everything is being disrupted and they're doing nothing about it. And nobody, but I think part of it's also, so when we had mass media, there was a lot of manipulation and, you know, it was marketing, right? Well, now with social media and a much more engaged sort of national debate, it's much more transparent. Marketing, people want authenticity. They mm-hmm. want to believe in stuff. They feel like they're being manipulated all the time, which they are. Madison Avenue, that's, you know, Mad Men. That was, but now I think with the change, so I think in that way it's related. But it's also all of the failures of America to live up to its ideals, which everyone, you know, particularly young people are very aware of, that, you know, we had these ideals of America and then we have what our leaders actually did. And they didn't always live up to the ideals. And so if you're 20, you've grown up thinking, well, the American project is illegitimate. Our leaders don't do what they say. Everything's manipulation. Nothing works. And look at this whole group of history where you guys said you believed in A, but you did B. And that's a real dangerous problem of how to restore people's belief that America is what we say it is. And both of those problems basically tie into, I think, to have a working country, an ordinary person has to believe, if I work hard and play by the rules, I'll be okay. I can, okay, there's always going to be the world beaters who go out to change the world. But a lot of people just want to have a stable system to have a decent life where they say, if I work hard and I play by the rules, the system will take care of me and I will have a good enough life that I'm happy with. And they have to believe that the system is set up to allow that. And I think a lot of these, all these problems together have disrupted that. And that creates a crisis of legitimacy where people think the country isn't, because if you can't provide that, right? It's not enough to just allow Steve Jobs to do Steve Jobs, which is important. You have to be able to unleash talent and ability and be able to innovate and create economic growth and all these things. But if you can't also let an ordinary person who doesn't want to do all that, they just want to get an education and plug themselves into the system and do a job and be treated with dignity and respect and have a decent life. Okay. If you can't provide that, the system loses its legitimacy. And all these problems together have threatened that, where people feel like, I don't think ordinary people can work hard and play by the rules and be okay. I feel like the system is rigged and I'm not being taken care of. And so fixing that is to convince everybody that that's true. And the only way you convince everybody that it's true is you make it true. You have to make sure that the system works, institutions do what they say, that leaders treat their jobs as duties and not as privileges, all of this. And it seems very basic and it seems like pablum sometimes, but it's a real problem and it's caused by these bigger crises. So that's where I'm currently at on how to solve this.
Yeah, I think I'll close with this then let you close out. But basically what I appreciate about what you just described is it gets to why it gets to basically what my core of the critique of the Forward Party movement is, at least the way they're articulating this. To your point, this could end up in a different direction. But everything I said and that you said really speaks to like ideology. Like these are actually very complicated questions that require a combination. And once again, neither of us have the answer, so I'm not trying to claim this is us, but like it requires a combination of political talent. It requires intellectual heft. It requires even just like luck. It requires a bunch of different factors, even timing. Timing is really, really critical here. You could have hyper-political, for example, Bill Clinton's a person who has hyper-political talent, but he did not line up with a moment. I think Bill Clinton is a Democrat. So for example, if Bill Clinton were Democrat, if Bill Clinton were the governor of Arkansas right now, I think he would be the president in 2024. I think he would find, I think he would have the political talent to get around this situation. He could do what Gavin Newsom can't do in terms of like the political talent. If Gavin Newsom has the narrative. He does not have the political talent to pull it off. So it requires so many things to do these things. And I think that just the problem forward is that they are focused on just increasing the variables, the factors, the players, but they are not setting themselves up, I think, to deeply answer these bigger questions that I think matter far more ahead of time. I don't think I said this to Andrew. We've done so many episodes, it's hard to keep track of this, but I said this to Sagar during a post-op. I was like, look, forward party goes well until someone at the big convention in 2023 says, hey, by the way, what's our position on Israel and boycott, divestment, and sanctions? Andrew got in a lot of like hot water about this in the New York mayoral primary because he was anti-BDS. He was pro-Israel. I'm both of those, of course, to give my position, but like having spoken to like a lot of Yang Gang folks, I would not say that like the typical center left Democratic Party position on Israel is at all going to be the norm there. And it's very easy to basically say, hey, like, let's just have more choices. But you actually have to do, but I think what makes something successful is you've actually developed a set of answers to questions that could even, that could stand up to when those conflicts happen. So, for example, obviously there's a big debate in the Democratic Party right now what the party's position on Israel is going to be, but it doesn't actually matter at a deeper electoral level because, to your point of what's the crisis, if you were a Democrat in 2020, the successful answer to what the crisis was is the crisis, it's Trump. Bernie framed the crisis as capitalism. AOC framed it as like generational change. Pete Buttigieg tried to do the generation thing, but Biden won because the actual opinion that the vast majority of Democrats and plenty of center-right people held was actually all that matters is that Trump should not be in office in 2021. That's it. Joe Biden, Barack Obama, third term. This is what sold, of course. That is the answer to the crisis. And the real issue right now is that was enough in the Democratic Party side to paper over debate about how you do with Israel and BDS, because the bigger answer of holy shit, Trump has to go, papered over that. I'm sure the progressives had all sorts of big debates. The issue going into 2024, if you're a forward party member, because they don't have any deeper, bigger ideological answer to the crisis, to the moment, even to the deeper critique, it's not actually enough to keep it together. Because as I'm articulating this here, and then I will actually let you close this out, I'm realizing that what Trump did so effectively is he merged the kind of like idea side with like the foofy political bit that people think is like fake. So people say, oh, like Trumpism like wasn't real, but like Trumpism circa 2015 was actually just a very good critique that perfectly navigated the Republican Party's dynamic. One, the central problem in America right now is that crooked Hillary is going to beat all these establishment losers and she's going to destroy America forever. That was his definition of the crisis. He actually was if that's your definition of the crisis, that was an actual answer. The crisis is that America doesn't have borders anymore. We're having our lunch eaten by the Europeans and the Chinese. We're going to put up a border wall. We're going to start a trade war. He perfectly mixed the like hyperbolic with the actually there is something there. And by the way, these are the areas. His position on China is now basically the bipartisan consensus. Obviously, a bunch of people were talking there, but he moved that. He killed, frankly, just the dovish side of the China debate on both sides of the aisle, effectively. He made it so the Republicans are not going to be pushing immigration reform, at least the way they were ever again. And that to me, without praising Trump, is basically what I would demand of anyone who either is trying to take over a political party, so to your point of the boarding, or who wants to start a new party. They have to be able to give, within the Trumpian framework I just set up, like what their version of that is. Because going back to previous party takeovers, you see the similar examples. Barry Goldwater, choice, not an echo. We are too much like Democrats. Eisenhower won, but what did that get us? It got us the advancement of liberalism. That is our crisis right now. That is what's going to lead this country into disaster. I'm offering you something different. That's a great critique. Rural America is underrepresented. 1896, that is a great, substance aside, good critique. On and on and on and on. I just hear nothing of that from the forward people. Like you when you describe there being not enough choice, you're basically trying to end run around these issues. And my point is, if the choices are just center left, center right technocracy. Actually, sorry, I'm ranting, but this is what I get heated about this. A political win is not a party of country club Republicans. A third party that's full of country club Republicans and Scott Galloway, Andrew Yang Democrats. That third party literally changes nothing. It makes some people who don't like institutions feel better about themselves, but that's not the actual crisis. Therefore, it doesn't actually save anything. And by the way, we all know Andrew Yang, if he were president, would appoint a center-left Democrat to the Supreme Court. He would favor an assault weapons ban, or he would definitely favor more gun control rather than less. And he almost certainly wouldn't be, and he would probably vote to impeach Trump. So how does having that third party, if you're coming up with the same answers as the center-left Democrats do, just with a different signpost on you, eh. So yeah, what's your response, and then we'll close out.
All right. I guess I agree, but I don't fully agree with the conclusion for the reasons I said. So I agree that the most important people at this moment are the people that nobody recognizes, which is the idea people, right? The most important task for anybody in politics right now, and it's the neglected task, is building a new ideology, building a workable, compelling ideology, okay? And that's the work of idea people and writers and wonks, right? This is the New Deal brain trust. This is the people at National Review, the conservative, right? You need to get people, and I think without regard to the political spectrum, wherever they used to find themselves, who have new, fresh ideas and pull them together with a new story about here's the problem, here's how we solve it. Mm-hmm. I think whoever does that wins. Whoever does that becomes a major party and reorients the whole system. And again, like the progressive movement, they don't have to even, they could build an ideological movement and then take over a party, or they could build it within a political party. It doesn't matter what you call the thing, but it is this boarding party of ideas. And I think whoever does that will control the next era of America, because somebody will eventually do it. And whoever does do it, if you can come up with a compelling story that half of 330 million people say, yeah, that's the crisis, and you have a way, you have an approach to solve it that can lead to an agenda that fixes all the things I'm worried about and allows me to feel comfortable that people like me are taken care of. If I work hard and play by the rules, I'll be okay. If you can do that, you will control the next era of America. And the question is merely with Forward, do they do that or not? Because if they do that, they will win. They are now, as I said, they bigfooted everybody else out. That's the banner that people are rallying behind, right? But with the Republican Party, when the Republican Party got created in the 1850s, there were all these little parties happening, and then the Republican banner came up, and everybody left their other little small parties and movements, and all fell under that banner. And I think Forward is now going to play that role in the third party space, that they're the one. So if they can do that, if they can pull the idea people together and come up with a compelling agenda, I think they win. And I think they knock off one of the parties. I think they can kill off one of the parties, either by merging with it and replacing it that way, or by actually just winning enough that one party crumbles and everybody fills in and they replace it. Okay. So I think they can do it, and I think they might. But if they don't, if you're right about what they do, then they'll fail. And then somebody else will do it. And they'll do it maybe as an ideological movement, right? That we build, that all these intellectuals come together. You know, we should be looking for the next National Review, right? A bunch of people coming together in a magazine probably somewhere that 4 years from now are going to control the ideological space of America and can seize a party. So that's what I think. But my take on Forward is, if you're right that they do what they say they're going to do instead of what I think they're going to do, then they're going to have all the problems that you just said. But given the opportunity that exists and the pressures that exist, I think there is a more than even chance that they figure out that the idea people come together and they actually create an ideology. And if they do that, then I think that they win and they replace a party. And if they don't do it, someone else is gonna.
That's a great place to end. Frank, this has been great. I'll have you back towards the end of the year, because once again, twice yearly. Really appreciate you coming on the show. Everyone should check out The Next Realignment, both the book and the podcast channel and all those good bits. Thank you so much for joining me on The Realignment.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.